Welcome to the UFO Files Show with your host, Jerry Pippin.
Okay, we have a jam-packed audience here at the Civic Center in Roswell. Hello, this is Jerry Pippin, and welcome to the UFO Files. And we have a man who's lived in Roswell for a long time now, but you're not a native at all. And he's a good friend of ours and an expert on almost everything, from pyramids to Area 51 and Roswell, of course. Dennis, welcome to the show.
Thank you, but you know I hate that word expert.
Yeah, I know that, and that's the reason I used it. I thought I'd get you going really right off the bat.
Always a pleasure to be on with you, Jerry.
This is Dennis Balthaser, and he's got a great website. And why don't you tell us about it?
My website is TruthSeeker, all one word, TruthSeeker@Roswell.com. And I've tried to concentrate my research on four areas in the years I've been doing it. And that's the 1947 Roswell incident, Area 51 up in Nevada, which doesn't and hasn't existed, according to the government, since 1955. Underground bases, primarily because of my civil engineering background. My interest was STEM for that. And then a few years ago, I was asked to join the advisory board of the Great Pyramids of Giza, which has been just fascinating research for me.
Yeah, we've talked to you in detail about the pyramid show, and we'll do another one some of these days. They send you the information, and you kind of talk about it. Someday you're going to go over there.
Yeah, I'm planning on trying to get over there as quickly as I can. We have about 31 worldwide researchers, physicists, scientists, Egyptologists on the board, from Russia, the Ukraine, from Italy, France, the United States, Canada. And these are all high-tech, highly educated people, and I was kind of curious why I was asked to get on it. But then I found out that there was some interest in the possibility of an ET connection with the building of the pyramids. And the factual information that we have tells us that the pyramids and the Sphinx are much, much older than we've been told over the years, so that's basically what we're researching.
And we do have a show of Dennis on our website if you'd like to check that out. Everything that we do is there for free, for download 24/7, forever, and most of the shows are also MP3 iPodcast as well. Dennis, I wanted you to come on early on a show here simply because you knew Walter Haut very well, and you've talked to him over the years, and you've done a lot of investigation about all of this. And in fact, you and Wendy
Connors
up in Albuquerque has fadeddisc.com. You guys made some videos, didn't you, and audios?
I got to know Walter really well because I was involved with the UFO Museum from 1996 until 1998. On the board of directors for a year, and also the UFO investigator for the museum during that time period when I was volunteering 70 hours a week at the museum. So I had the occasion to talk to Walter Haut, Glenn Dennis, the mortician at the time in 47, and I talked to them daily, not only about UFOs, but about their personal life and things like that. And Walter was doing an interview with a French documentary company.
Right, and we played an excerpt. Wendy gave us an excerpt.
In that interview, he made a comment about bodies. And I had never heard Walter talk about that before. And Wendy Connors and I both were sitting there when he made the comment, and we looked at each other, went outside, and said, "We have to get this on tape." So we worked with it and got his daughter, who is the director of the museum, and Walter, to agree for us to do an oral history on Walter. And what we wanted to do was to get Walter on videotape so that for historical value, if nothing else, and for his family, there would be some record of Walter's life, because he had an extremely interesting life. As a child, he grew up in the Chicago area. He worked in drugstores as a runner, would deliver things for the drugstore, and his favorite people to deliver to were the Capone family. And the reason he liked delivering to the Capone family was because everybody else tipped about 25 or 50 cents, and the Capone family would tip him $5 or $10 every time he delivered something. So he was a good businessman back then.
Yeah.
And then he entered the military and went through bombardier school. He had 35 missions over Japan as a bombardier. And he said he enjoyed that job because from the island where they were flying up to Japan was about a 15-18 hour round trip. And he'd sleep on the way up. The pilot or the co-pilot would kick him on the shoulder up in the front of the airplane, wake him up. He'd set up his Norton bomb sights, drop the load, and then go back to sleep. So he said it was a good job. And then he had the fortune, I guess it's fortune, of being the man who dropped the instrument in the mushroom cloud when they tested the atomic bomb in the Pacific. And I used to kid him about that and ask him, did you glow? And he said, no, I didn't glow, but he said it was kind of bumpy going through the clouds. So that was pretty historical to be involved with that. And then was assigned here to Roswell under Colonel Blanchard and became the public relations officer. And during the interview that we did on videotape, and I'm going to have to admit, I haven't read the new book yet that has the affidavit in it. I've heard reviews and read reviews of it. But what I have seen of the affidavit, it is very precise as far as dates and locations and people. And that bothers me a little bit because in the oral history we did on videotape, Walter couldn't remember where he took basic training. He couldn't remember names. He couldn't do this or that. And there was a two-year gap. We did the interview on videotape in 2000. The affidavit was supposedly signed in 2002. So either he had a tremendous revision of his memory, or perhaps someone else wrote the document and he signed it. We don't know that, and that's something we're going to have to determine. So until I've had a chance to really study the affidavit and do some more research, basically that's all I know about it.
Well, basically you do know Walter, though, and I met him. He was in not very good health the day we talked to him, so we didn't put the interview on the air. In fact, he was a rather weak voiced even in 2000 in your show.
He was.
You did.
And that's one of the things that bothered us. Now, when we did the interview, and I love Wendy Connors tremendously, but I thought she led him on. She asked the same question over and over and over.
He answered, right?
Until he got an answer she wanted. And that's not a good way to do an interview or research. But there's a whole lot we have to look at this. And if the affidavit is correct, the new affidavit, the information is correct, then the video could possibly...
Let me run some things down that you know about him, and let me just ask you what you think about it. And first of all, he's purportedly, according to the new book, was a very good personal friend of Colonel Blanchard.
Very much. He, in fact...
Now, he was the commander of the base.
Colonel Blanchard was the base commander and head of the 509th Bomb Wing. He went on to become a four-star general and was considered for Joint Chief of Staff in Washington at the Pentagon. Had a heart attack in the war room at the Pentagon a day after he had a physical. But Walter and Colonel Blanchard were very close, and Walter talked a lot about the old man would call me in, and he'd say, what do you think about this? He said, here I am, a lieutenant, and the colonel's asking me questions and wanting my advice. But when Colonel Blanchard passed away, I understand that Walter was one of the first people notified.
So that part, and we've known that before, they were very good friends. So this would explain how he is a lieutenant, maybe was able to go out to the hangar where the bodies were. He says he told you he saw, what, one or two?
One body at the hangar.
Yeah, later on in this affidavit, they say two.
Yeah, he said he saw a body partially covered in a tarp from about 20 or 25 feet away, and he described it as child size.
In fact, in the affidavit, I think he says... Or maybe in an interview that one of the researchers did, he said he was this high holding his hand up like a 10 or 11-year-old child.
Right. That was the same information we got.
Yeah. And so that part we know, at least there was one, maybe two. How many survivors or victims do you think, ETs I'm talking about, dead extraterrestrials, do you think there really were?
Well,
I have came up with a count of five. Is that right?
I've heard anywhere from three to five, and I've heard one or two still alive at the time. That all still has to be verified, but anywhere from three to five bodies.
Yeah, so, and the thing that I thought was interesting that grabbed my attention, I've been covering Roswell and UFOs for 40-some-odd years, and I really wasn't aware of this this other, I call it an escape pod crash, but I don't know, about 45 miles from here. What can you tell me about that?
Stanton Friedman and I have talked about this, that comment that there's a site 40
right, and
miles.
I had Larry Dickin, the executive producer of our show, had a long conversation with Stanton about it. He's not convinced either.
I don't know where the site is. They're talking about a site 40 miles. In my lecture yesterday, I talk about three sites. One is the Corona debris site where Mac Brazel, the ranch foreman, found the material, which to me is the basically the only valid site that we have. Then you have the Corn Ranch site, which are promoted. They're promoting here at the convention this year, and they're taking tours out there. I got an affidavit from the McKnight children, whose daddy owned that ranch in 1947, and they said nothing happened there. Corn bought the site a few years ago. He wasn't even born when this happened.
Mm-hmm.
And the other site that we talk about is the Ragsdale site out in the Capitan Mountain west of town.
Now he's passed away too. Now.
1995, he passed away, but before he did, he gave two affidavits.
Yeah, and he has a DVD out of Deathbed Confession,
which the museum was promoting. I think there was some connection there between the profit from that for the museum and the research. And I never put any confidence in the Ragsdale site at all because it was two different affidavits, two different locations, two different stories, which has never been verified.
Now, his daughter lives here,
yep.
And she runs a liquor store, I think.
I believe that's right, yep.
Yeah. So before we leave on Monday, we're going to try to track her down.
Okay.
But that's one of the things that I'd like to bring up as a researcher. I know it's got to be just... to make you want to pull your hair out, the Undertaker's beating us to the...
Well, that and the frustration. I lose between $2,000 and $4,000 a year doing this research, and my wife's good enough to let me do that. But I think what I'm doing is important, and I think the information, trying to determine the truth, is of such importance, maybe not to me. I went on Medicare in October, and everything's been downhill since then. But... You know, at my age...
I'm sorry to hear that. I'm not laughing about it, but I can identify with it. I'm a little older than you, even.
At my age, I used to think that we'll know the truth in my lifetime, and I've about given up on that, and I'm just hopeful that what I'm doing will help get the truth for my children or my grandchildren, because there's two things that bother me. One is the media, the national media. They don't represent us in any way, shape, or form. Stanton Friedman, Jesse Marcel, Don Schmidt, and I did a National Geographic special last year. That was one of the most biased shows I've ever been involved in. When it came out, it was an absolute disaster, and I'm convinced it was done for profit and ratings. Had nothing to do with factual information. The other concern I have is our young people in this country are accepting the fact that we live in a country of cover-up. The Kennedy assassination, Watergate, Vietnam, Iran-Contra, those are all cover-ups. And it's time for our young people to start asking questions of the government and demanding answers.
Dennis Balthaser is our guest here, and actually he pronounces his name Balthaser.
Balthaser, right? Balthaser, that's close enough.
Right, and I have a mental block with this. Dennis first came on the air with me, and the radio show is still available. From I think
that.
2000 or 2001.
That was a long time ago.
Yeah, and I had trouble with his name the first night, and 7 years later, I'm still having trouble. But that's okay. People call me Pipin.
I carry business cards so I can spell it.
Yeah. You talked about questions. We're going to go to the audience if they have some questions, and I have some more questions. We're broadcasting from Roswell, the 60th anniversary. I'm Jerry Pippin. The biggest secret ever is about to be revealed. Fast Walkers, UFO and Alien Disclosure.
Words you were never meant to hear.
It's clear we're dealing with a cosmic Watergate.
This is the biggest secret in the history of the human race, the known modern history of government.
Photos you were never meant to see. Video you never knew existed. People you were never meant to meet.
As Jack Nicholson would say, you can't handle the truth.
Essentially everything that you would want to know has been covered up.
Things you were never meant to know about.
No one has produced a higher quality, better produced DVD anytime anywhere. Fast Walkers, now available on DVD for only $19.95 at ShopJerryPippin.com. Hello, everyone. Jerry Pippin, and we're back here with our UFO files, and we're broadcasting from Roswell, the 60th anniversary. Dennis Balthaser is our... almost got it. I didn't quite get it, but I got it close, Dennis.
Right. Very good, Jerry.
Yeah, he is our guest, truthseekers.com. Is that close enough?
Truthseeker at Roswell.
Yeah, okay, good. I want to get the whole thing here. We do have a link on all of this, so I'm saved by the bell. You guys were up in someplace else in Colorado, right? Or New Mexico. And you heard about this place. Is that right?
We listened to
Well, you can mention the competition. That's okay.
We listened to Coast to Coast.
It's not competition. We're all in this together.
Pretty much all, you know, every night. It's sort of our thing. And, you know, the fascination... we grew up during the 50s and 60s in Los Angeles, and I know there was lots of testing done in Nevada. Mm-hmm. I remember when my mother would say to me, "We have to shut the windows and close the drapes because they're doing some testing," and I remember having to play inside. And my question is, what do we know? We talked about Hangar 51. What do you believe about the possibility that a lot of radiation did drift into the Los Angeles area? Because all of my friends, I'm 58 years old, and I'm...
You're kidding me.
No.
I thought I looked okay, but this lady, she doesn't look 58. Don't tell me your husband's the same age.
Yes,
I thought you married a child.
We grew up together. We met when we were 15 years old, and we were first loves, and... just got together 40 years later. But anyway, almost everyone I know my age in my class, we just had our 40th reunion, is afflicted with some kind of rare cancer or a disease that the onset was at a very early age.
Like, right. We've got your name. We need to give you your name.
Diane.
Okay.
I'd really like to know about... the Hangar 51 and what went on in Nevada. And
she's talking about Area 51, Dennis. What about, we talked about medical problems earlier. There does seem to be a lot of...
There have been a lot of stories, conspiracy stories about radiation over the years that people were involved with this, had mysterious deaths. One, the most popular one, of course, is Congressman Schiff from New Mexico. He wound up with a facial cancer after he had requested information from the General Accounting Office. Was there a connection? I don't think so. But Area 51, we know they do toxic waste disposal on top of the ground. The President of the United States, starting with Bill Clinton, puts out a proclamation every year that can be picked up on the Internet, stating that Area 51, Groom Lake, which it's called up in Nevada, is exempt from environmental law. The only corporation, business, operation in the entire country that gets away with burning toxic fuel or toxic waste above ground. There were two gentlemen who died of exposure. The wives, when they found out about it, their husbands worked at Area 51. They didn't know what they did. They filed a lawsuit against the United States government. When that went to court, the judge wasn't allowed to look at the paperwork because of the secrecy with the base. And the judge told them, you can't sue something that doesn't exist, indicating that the base wasn't even there when it's been there since 1955.
Well, you were just up there.
I was up there last May, and I did two lectures at Rachel next to the little alien inn. I went out to both the gates, harassed the guards while I was there. There's a 13-mile dirt road from the extraterrestrial highway back towards the mountains where the base is located on the other side of the mountain. And I told my wife, I said, we get down here about 10 miles, start watching the hills because you'll see a Jeep or a truck, and they'll be looking for us. Well, we came around one of those little sand dunes to where the entrance is, where the signs are. Sure enough, sitting up in the hill was a pickup truck, two camo dudes, which are called the two guards in camouflage uniforms, binoculars watching us. They already had all the information on me they needed. They have sensors along the road coming in there. They'll know your truck license number. They can run a check on you. By the time you get to the gate, they know who you are and where you're from and what you're doing. They also have systems set up where they can listen to you talk. That was at the back gate, which is the most popular gate. The other gate is where the guardhouse is. They have two gates, one with a stop sign. If that opens, you go in. There's another one. The back one closes. You don't go in there unless you're delivering something to the base. But they have a camera mounted about 30 feet in the air on a tower. And I walked down along the property line, and that camera followed me everywhere I went. If I stopped, the camera stopped. And I'd turn around, I'd wave at it every so often to let the guard know I was okay in doing it and doing my job. But one of the questions that I raise, we have a lot of problems with the border, with our Mexican border and Canadian border. Area 51 has been in existence since 1955. It was opened by the CIA to test the U-2 aircraft. Nobody has ever penetrated Area 51. So maybe on our border, we need a sign that says the use of deadly force is authorized. Maybe we can do something about that border. Have them guards sitting there, loaded rifles, ready to go. If you should happen to go across up there, you're going to be brought into the sheriff's office. They'll contact the local sheriff. You'll be interrogated. You may be fined anywhere from $5,000 to $10,000, and I'll guarantee you they'll know where you're at for the rest of your life. But on the conspiracy theory, on the cancer, I don't see a connection. I think maybe it's partially a conspiracy.
Okay, you know, Dennis, when we talk about that, there's even a conspiracy theory that maybe Congressman Schiff was given this cancer because he was really wide open to investigating UFOs.
Yeah, there's been several researchers that have had kind of mysterious deaths. Going back to 1947, James Forrestal, when was Secretary of Defense and Secretary of the Navy, when he was admitted to the hospital with mental problems, he jumped out of the hospital and committed suicide. But the room he was in at the hospital is the only room that didn't have bars on the window. So the conspiracy theory is that he was helped out that window because he was going to go public with information. Marilyn Monroe, Don Burleson did a lecture yesterday that the Kennedy association with Marilyn Monroe had something to do with her death. These are all theories we don't know. Good question.
Okay, this is Jerry Pippin, and we deal in conspiracies a lot, and as Dennis says, that's the reason they're conspiracy theories, is we don't get too many people to talk, which I you know, my big deal is I like to get people to tell me the real truth, and basically when they're facing huge fines, prison sentences, ostracization from everybody else they worked with, they usually just don't talk. Can't really get them. Your name, sir?
Joe Bookman.
And where are you from?
Park City, Utah.
Okay, welcome to Roswell. You have a question for Dennis or a statement?
I do. I'm curious. Go back to the Foster Ranch in July of 47. What's your theory about what was happening 1 minute before the debris started falling? Was there one ship that exploded or two ships that bumped each other? Or can you go back in time just a little bit before the first thing hit the ground?
Yeah, Dennis, we've had all kinds of theories, and there seems to be a shoot-down theory now going on.
Yeah, well, here we go again with theories.
Yeah, okay.
I'm just curious about your best guess or informed research.
Let me give you my best guess first and what we've heard from ranch foreman Mac Brassel, who was the ranch foreman on the Foster Ranch near Corona. He said that he heard an explosion louder than thunder on the night of July 4th, 1947, about 11:30 at night, during a severe thunderstorm. Now, out here in the southwest, we can have a thunderstorm 60 miles away from here, and here in Roswell, the stars are out and the moon's shining. That's typical. So we have gone back and checked weather reports, and yes, there was a storm. Now, this rancher would know the sound of a thunderstorm. The next morning, he went out to check on his sheep and his windmills for damage from the storm the night before. His sheep wouldn't go across the debris field. Took them around it to get them to water. One of the theories that Stanton Friedman talks about is a two-vehicle crash west of here, out near the plains of St. Augustine, west of Socorro. His theory is that they had a mid-air collision. One went down at the Plains of St. Augustine. The other one came in and came down at the Corona Ranch. Schmidt and Randall, in their book in the early 90s, talked about the craft hit the ground at the Corona site, went airborne, and crashed at the Corn Ranch site. I believe the Corn Ranch site was a diversionary site. I don't think anything ever happened there because of the affidavit I got from the McKnight family. Bragsdale talked about a flash in the sky brighter than a welder's arc, and that the thing came in to Boy Scout Mountain, where him and his girlfriend were laying in the back of a pickup, buck naked, having a good time, end quote.
These New Mexico guys know how to live.
Huh? You bet. We don't put a lot of confidence in that. There's also a theory about it being shot down, perhaps. Now, one theory that has come up that I'm wanting to look at is the use of microwave radar. There were remote microwave radars set up at Fort Sumner. There were some up at Moriarty. The military has some of these set up somewhere. Depending on the propulsion system and guidance system of these craft, that type of radar could interfere with it, as could a thunderstorm with lightning. Depending where they're from, if they don't know what lightning is, the electrical storm could have had an effect on the guidance or the propulsion system. Most times when an aircraft goes down, be it a commercial or a military airplane, it's usually pilot error. Very seldom is it mechanical problems. But just based on the fact that this could be something from out there, they may not have been used to the microwave or to the electrical storm.
On the crash, if it were a shoot down or a collision, and we had the surviving ET, do you have any information on the one or two that possibly survived? What's your best guess about that? Do you just not know if anyone thinks so?
Well, if I don't know, I'll tell you. But my best guess is that the bodies were probably taken, as was the debris, to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Ohio, which was Wright Field back then. The reason for that was they had research and development there from the Second World War with things we had captured from the Germans during the Second World War. They also had cold storage facilities there for bodies. Now, I have heard stories that there possibly could have been a body taken to Los Alamos, a national lab in northern New Mexico, even down to White Sands. This state is just absolutely full of secretive stuff. And most people don't realize New Mexico is just a gold mine for secrets and military and high-tech stuff that takes place.
But that's true.
But I think most researchers agree that the material and the bodies were probably taken to Wright Field in Ohio, Dayton, Ohio.
Anyone else have a question? Yes, sir. Come this way a little bit. Our microphone cord, we don't have one of those.
You know, for 20 cents, you could have got another foot of mic cord.
My name is Diane also. I'm from Katy, Texas.
Katy, Texas.
Yes. I would like to know what happened to the nurse that went. The nurse that went in and actually saw the body.
You know the Glenn Dennett story?
What happened to the nurse? I hear that she was engaged and her fiancé never heard from her again.
Well, the story we have from Glenn Dennis, who was a mortician in 47, was that he went to the base infirmary, the hospital, and a nurse he knew came out of a room with her face covered, nauseated, and told him to get out of there. The next day, she said she wanted to meet Glenn Dennis at the officers' club. They met. And on the back of a prescription pad, she drew a picture of a face of an alien and the hands of an alien. She gave that to Glenn Dennis. He called back the next day because he said she was very upset. He called back the next day to check on her and was told that she had been shipped out to Europe. And he wrote to her, and his letter supposedly came back with a red stamp on it, said deceased. Now, the story he got was that she was killed in a plane crash in Europe. There is no record of a plane crash in Europe. Glenn has not changed his story over the years very much. I'm one of the few researchers that has a problem with his story. We can't find any of the witnesses that he talked about. The 6'2" red-headed captain that threatened him, said you'd get your bones picked out of the desert. The nurse, But more importantly, he supposedly took that picture, that drawing, and put it in a safe at Ballard Funeral Home, where he was the mortician. Years later, Stanton Friedman and him went to the Ballard Funeral Home to get this piece of paper out of the safe, and it wasn't there. Glenn doesn't know whether he lost it or if it was taken. So he sent two researchers on a wild goose chase for 5 years with the name of the nurse. Gave him the wrong name.
Dennis, you knew Glenn. Did you ever ask him about that?
I asked him many times, and his story didn't change. But that's one of the problems I have. But you can see where these two pieces of evidence would be extremely important. Getting that piece of paper with the drawing of the alien face and the hands, and then secondly, the nurse disappearing and no record of that. Glenn today will tell you that she was a Catholic and she went to a convent, thank you, that she was in a convent and that he's protecting her. He didn't want to give her name because he wanted to protect her.
He just gave me the killed in action story.
Yeah. I don't know what the relationship was. Glenn was a married man at the time. And I don't know what his relationship was with the nurse, and I'm probably speaking out of turn here by doing this, but if that's the truth, I want it out.
He was a friend of hers.
He was a friend. Yeah, we know that.
Men and women can be friends.
My other question is...
You pay for two questions?
Sure.
We doubled them.
Okay.
We see green aliens everywhere, and then I heard yesterday... Somebody said they weren't green.
I don't know of any little green men, do you?
The statement, they weren't green, goes back to Mac Brazel, the rancher. He came to town, was interrogated out of the base for several days. When he left town, he stopped at the radio station, KGFL, talked to Frank Joyce, and changed his story.
Oh.
He said what he had seen was actually 2 weeks ago instead of last week, and that it was a weather balloon, and he was wrong about what he had seen after being interrogated.
Scared.
And then...
Yeah, they kept him without a warrant or any charges.
And then Frank Joyce at the radio station said, Mac, he said, are you talking about those little green men? And Mac spun around in his cowboy boots and said they weren't green.
Well, I wish he had said what color they were.
And that was the only comment he ever made about the bodies. Now... The aliens that you see on books and on magazines with the big eyes and stuff like that, that sells product. Most people here refer to the aliens in Roswell as almost humanoid looking, except for size. Mm-hmm. They have a humanoid appearance to them, but they have larger eyes, longer arms, the number of fingers changes, 3, 4, 5, whatever. But they're not the grays that you see on TV. That's not what crashed here. They're more humanoid.
I have one other comment. A couple of weeks ago, when I first came to Roswell, I went to a garage sale, and the man that had the garage sale retired from Area 51. So,
Well, where was that garage sale? I need to go.
I'm not going to say.
I'm going to get sign her on here.
Will you share that with me later?
Sure. And you know, of course, he said nothing, and I'm a novice. The big tie I have to this is I was born in 1947.
That explains a lot of it right there then. If you were born in 47.
Right. It's a good year.
You're interviewing an alien.
Yes. I was in vitro at the time. Almost born. But everybody seems to know about the Area 51.
Well, it went public. We found out about it through a Russian satellite picture.
Yeah,
American people were lied to for years. Mm-hmm. It was opened in 1955 by the CIA to test the U-2 aircraft. They needed a location to test that airplane that was secretive. Edwards Air Force Base wasn't secretive enough. And every airplane since then has been test flown there. A good example of the American government able to keep secrets, the F-117 Stealth, which is located at Holloman Air Force Base down the road from here, that was on the drawing board in 1973. We found out about it in 1991 in the Gulf War.
So it couldn't have been flying before 73?
The F-117?
Right.
No.
What, the stealth?
No. We don't think so.
No.
Thank you very much. You know, you talk about the government and their how to keep secrets. they're masters at redirection, I've found. In other words, if you get a little information about something, they'll give that up. It's kind of like a poker game. Yeah, okay, you got that. And then they just push everything that way, away from the real place.
And Jerry, that's a good point. That's what I'm trying to emphasize to the audience this morning, is that let's start asking questions and demanding answers of our government. You know, we can't continue to live with this cover-up. At lectures, I ask people, name five people in the government you respect. I'm getting the same blank look this morning.
You're true. It's a good point. And the problem is these guys seem to think that we work for them, and it's the other way around.
We the people.
Yeah, supposedly. Dennis Balthaser, it's always great to have you here. We could go on for hours, but we have other guests.
Oh, so sure.
Thank you very much, and let's plug that website one more time.
Thank you. TruthSeeker@Roswell.com.
This is Jerry Pippin. We'll be right back.